morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's dot foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. In just a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with Tom Bowles. He's the science advisor to Governor Bill Richardson. Right now, I would like to welcome David Geist. He is a cabaret performer, pianist, and music producer. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
It's good to have you back. We had you on a couple of times in, over the last few years, and you've moved to Santa Fe 3 years ago, taken Santa Fe by storm in terms of the cabaret music scene, which basically revolves around you. And there is something coming up, which is the 2008 Santa Fe Cabaret Conference in early December, the 5th, 6th, and 7th of December.
This is all true. Yeah, Santa Fe has been wonderful to me, and I'm loving it. And I have this wonderful cabaret room called Geist Cabaret at Pronzo.
I love the way you just moved to Santa Fe, and they named a room after you.
Well, like we were talking earlier, things are meant to be, and I have wonderful passion for my music making, and I really wanted to come here and offer it to this community, and it's really, this community has been incredibly receptive, so I couldn't ask for anything more, so I'm so grateful for that.
So what's this cabaret conference all about?
Well, the art of cabaret, as we know it in this present time, is really about the intimate song performance in these small venues like Geist Cabaret. And there are people that make careers out of this. There's rooms in New York like the Algonquin and Feinstein's at the Regency and the Cafe Carlyle. And these two particular people, Lena Koutrakos and Rick Jensen, are some friends of mine from New York, and they have careers in that field, and they work in New York City, and they do workshops all over the country. And last year we had them for the first workshop, first annual Santa Fe Cabaret Conference workshop, and it was wildly received. People just loved it, and it was life-changing, and you could tell people that had taken it really felt like they had gone through this amazing artistic retreat. So
It's four singers.
That is true. You could be a solo pianist. I mean, you know, I sing as well, but a lot of times in my cabaret performances, I play piano and I tell stories that lead into the pieces that I play. So it's really another form of storytelling, but for the most part, yeah, we're taking singers. If you're an instrumentalist and you want to incorporate storytelling into your instrumental music making, this would be for you as well. So it really could apply to that, but for the most part, cabaret, as we know it, is singing.
And so when you teach or when your colleagues teach cabaret singing, there's some sort of magical combination of heart and craft that goes into it.
Absolutely. I mean, singing is probably one of the most vulnerable ways of expressing yourself musically, you know, just the voice alone. Obviously, you work with pianists. But singing, these are stories, you know, whether you're singing songs from the 20s or the 30s or even a Beatles song, but, you know, you have your text, and your text infuses your storytelling. And so that's really what it's about, is to, you bring your handle on these stories, you know, through singing and through wonderful direction that you're going to get from these people. So it really is, to me, singing is an extension of speaking. They really revolve in the same world, so to speak. So if you can speak, you can sing. But it's really about being a storyteller first and foremost.
And so this is what's going to be taught at the Santa Fe Cabaret Conference, and people can find more about that at the Cabaret Hotline.
Indeed.
Which is 989-9007, 505-989-9007.
Perfect.
When are you playing at the Geist Cabaret Room at Pronzo in Santa Fe?
I am there most Wednesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays, and Sundays. This particular weekend I won't be in, but I have wonderful people that are on when I'm not there. But for the most part, I'm there generally four nights a week and 6 to 9, and it's this beautiful upstairs intimate setting, and I'm very proud of it. I'd love to see everyone up there, and I'm really enjoying preserving all this wonderful material, you know, songs of Gershwin and Porter and Jerome Kern. And
which the many retired people who've moved here to Santa Fe to have a nice retirement love and come out for.
Well, they do. I really get an audience, you know, obviously of elderly people, but, you know, younger people, too, are starting to really gravitate towards this. I mean, you know, Rod Stewart, Katie Lang, I mean, a lot of contemporary people have made, Carly Simon have made their cover CDs of, you know, this wonderful material, because it really is it's lasting material. Harry Connick Jr. is also another one of those people.
David Geist, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Once again, the Cabaret Hotline. Telephone number is 989-9007. And we're going to go out with some of your music, The Man I Love.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
And I'd like to welcome now Tom Bowles. He's the science advisor to Governor Bill Richardson, and he is going to be speaking tonight, October 20th, from 6 to 7 at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Annex as part of the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Pleased to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Great to have you. Your talk is titled, We're Missing Most of the Universe. What does that mean?
Well, it means quite literally what it says, namely that we don't know what most of the universe is made up of.
Meaning, we know that there's galaxies and...
Right. So if you go back in history, you know, the Greeks believed that the universe, as we knew it, was made up of earth, air, fire, and water. And they also put forward the idea that there was an indivisible entity called an atom, and that was the smallest component of anything in the universe. Well, you know what we call atoms now consist of a nucleus and electrons going around it, and if you look within the nucleus, there's neutrons and protons, but they're made up of yet smaller things called quarks. And so the question is, you know, how far down does that go? That's one question. The other question is, if you take all of the atoms that we know in the universe, and you add them all up. So you add up all the mass from all the visible stars in the universe, you find out that it accounts for less than 1% of all the mass that's out there.
And now, how do you measure how much mass there is out there?
So if you look at galaxies, you look at stars on the edge of galaxies, you look to see how fast they're moving around the galaxy, and so you know about what the mass of the star is, you know how far out they are, you know how fast they're going around. So from that you can calculate what the total mass within that orbit is.
Just because of gravitation.
Just because of gravitation, exactly. And so when you do that, what you find out is that there is a large component of mass that is not accounted for from the normal things that we know.
You can't see it, you can't measure it, but it's pulling things.
It's pulling things in. And there's a series of observations that you can make to look to see how much of hydrogen, how much helium there is, how much of other elements. You can put all these things together into a puzzle that says, okay, here's the total mass of the universe. We know that from these gravitational observations. We measure how many stars we observe, and you just figure out what percentage that is. It's less than a percent. And then you add in all of the gas and all of the dust and everything that's in galaxies, the amount that we've calculated in intergalactic space, and you come up with an answer that says less than 5% of the mass of the universe are the things that we're used to. So the question is, what's the other 95% of the mass of the universe? So until 10 years ago, we thought that a lot of it was something we called dark matter. We called it dark because it doesn't give off light, but it is affected by gravity. It produces gravity. And so it's dark in the sense it doesn't give off light. It's also dark in the sense that we really didn't know what that matter was.
You compare it to terra incognita on the old maps.
Right, exactly. So that was the view up until 10 years ago. So you got a little bit of what we call normal matter that we're used to, all the stuff around us. Most of the rest was thought to be this dark matter. And then we discovered that that was not correct either. Some of it is dark matter, but there was something else in the universe that wasn't dark matter and was called dark energy, basically, for the lack of another term. So dark matter is gravitational. It attracts matter together. There's something else in the universe that is pushing things apart, and that's called dark energy. And right now we have no idea what that is, except when you do observations of galaxies, distant clusters of galaxies and so on, figure out how much mass is there, how they're moving relative to one another, you end up with this sort of recipe that says up to 5% of the universe is made up of things we're used to that we know about. 30% is made up of dark matter, which is gravitational, but we don't know what it consists of. And the rest of it is this dark energy.
Now, whereas dark matter pulls things in the way the sun pulls planets toward itself, dark energy pushes them away?
It's a repulsive force. So gravity is always an attractive force. There's some other force out there which is repulsive in nature.
And so you get near dark energy and it pushes you to the other side of the room.
Well, basically, it acts on very large scales. So it's like gravity. It's very weak. It's not something which, you know, is going to pick you up and throw you against the wall. But there's a very interesting connection between what we know about the basis of matter and what we know about the structure of the universe. And so if you go back to the beginning of the universe, the Big Bang, right when the universe was created, there was just energy in the universe. And, you know, from Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared, we know that you can transmute energy into matter and back. And so out of energy, you can make equal amounts. You can make a particle and an antiparticle. You have to make them together. They can annihilate, make energy again. And so for the first part of the universe, there was just this bath called a quark gluon plasma. Very elementary particles and energy in just this incredibly intense maelstrom. That started expanding outward. And after the first 1/1,000,000,000th of a second, the universe had expanded enough, it had cooled down in that expansion, that now you could form the components of nuclei, so neutrons and protons. During that time, the universe was expanding extremely quickly. For the next 3 minutes of the universe, you had this expansion going on. You got to the point where now all the the particles that we know as normal matter were stable after the first 3 minutes. The universe was said the universe froze out, which means that this back and forth between energy and mass stopped. Things were converted into mass, and they no longer were going to go back into energy. So that's our first glimpse, really, back to an early epoch in the universe. So you had all this mass that had been produced. The universe was still expanding, but it was slowing down because of gravity. And so for the first 400,000 years of the universe, things were slowing down because of gravity. And then this new force, dark energy, started kicking in. And instead of the universe just continuing to slow down and blowing up, you know, to a limited size, this dark energy started kicking in. And the universe started expanding again, accelerating away from each other. And so our current view is that the universe is going to expand forever. So our own galaxy will end up isolated from everything else in the rest of the universe, but not for 50 or 60 billion years, so it's not exactly...
not within our lifetimes.
Right, an imminent concern. But now we're trying to understand, what is this trade-off between gravity and this new force, and how do those translate down to new types of matter or energy that... I mean, what are those forms of matter and energy? So people are asking some very difficult questions. There's ways to actually explore these things. One is through astronomy. You look back in time by looking out to the edges of the universe, and basically you're looking back to a time in the universe when it was much hotter, much denser, much more compact. And so you can really look back in time by looking out to the edges of the universe.
Now, the universe has edges?
Well, the visible edge of the universe. So the universe goes on forever, as far as we can tell.
Well, that's something that's hard to conceive of, because when you talk about it's expanding, how can something that's already infinite be expanding?
So you can have all the parts within an infinite medium expanding away from one another, and all that you can observe is the part that you have itself. So there's sort of a local bubble, if you will, that defines how far out we can see in time, or back in time, how far out we can see in the universe. And that's because as the universe expands out and you get further and further away, there's an effect called the Doppler effect. So just the same way when a train is coming towards you, the pitch goes up. When it's going away, the pitch goes down. As you go further out and things are moving very quickly in the early times, things get shifted towards the red, and so there's this what's called a red shift. And the light gets pushed back so far in energy, or it's lowered in energy by shifting to much longer wavelengths, that the light just becomes redder and redder and redder, and it gets to a point where you just can't see out beyond that. And that sort of forms the edge of the visible universe.
That's a pretty geocentric, human-centric viewpoint,
yeah,
of that.
It is, but you know, we're the center of our visible universe. Somewhere else in a distant part of the universe would be the center of there.
So someone else on that edge can see a whole
can see
other
another
range
part
of,
yeah, further out.
But still, I mean, when you talk about the Big Bang, this is something I've never understood, or frankly given all that much thought. But when you have a compression, again, you think about this tiny amount of mass, matter, stuff, mm-hmm, in the size of a walnut that becomes the whole universe. I mean, what was outside of that? Just nothing?
It's a very good question, and it's one that we can't answer. There's lots of theories about other universes. Are we part of something larger or not? You know, science can only probe to what we can observe. And at a certain point, you can't look beyond that. Because light has shifted so far that it takes forever to get to you. And, you know, what started the Big Bang? that's a question for philosophy, actually, not for science.
Well, it is a question for philosophy in the sense that when you read Aristotle and you think about the unmoved mover and stuff like that, you wonder if there are parallels. Do you have any point of view on that, or have you? Do you see the actual parallels between that kind of Big Bang astrophysics and philosophy?
There certainly are. I think the real question there is, how much can we know, and how much do you then have to intuit and take on faith? And there is a dividing line there. We keep moving that dividing line over time. As our knowledge extends, we can understand what we know better, what we don't know. There comes to a point where it may or may not be possible to look in to see, are there parallel universes? There are some very exotic ideas about wormholes in space and things like that. Can you ever prove that, disprove it? It's very difficult to say. You know, what happens when you go through a black hole, into a black hole? Does it simply terminate? Is it connected to something else?
Well, they've covered that on Star Trek.
Right. There's actually a very interesting book called The Physics of Star Trek. It was written by a friend of mine from Case Western. And he talks about what is real, what you could do in Star Trek based on physical laws, and what you can't do. And there are some things you can do and some things you can't do still.
But it is, I mean, kidding aside, I mean, it certainly is very rich matter for the literary imagination.
Oh, absolutely. And if you look at science, I mean, one of the things that I really enjoy about science is that science is really as much of an art as the visual arts or graphic arts, because you're looking at something, it's there, like a rock, and you're trying to visualize, if you're a sculptor, what lives within that rock. How do you pull something out of it to create something new? You have to be able to see inside, what's the structure, where are the faults, where would you make cuts? Same thing in science. You get all this information. You got this body of observations. What's important? What are the central elements? How are they connected together? And ultimately, you know, the quest in science is to understand the universe around us, the physical world, and its connections between different components. And one of the central tenets of physics is that simplicity is beauty. So if you look at, it's actually quite interesting, because if you look at the Greeks, they had four fundamental elements: earth, air, fire, and water. If you look at, currently, we believe there's four forces in nature. There's gravity. Everybody understands gravity. You have experience with it. There is electromagnetism, which is light and heat and all of those things around us. And then there's two nuclear forces, a strong nuclear force that holds nuclei together, and then there's a weak nuclear force that causes radioactivity, splits things apart. So just as the Greeks had four basic, you know, elements, we have four basic forces. There may be more than that. We don't know what's dark energy and so on. But the goal of physics is to figure out what the relations between those forces are. And Einstein believed very much in something called grand unification, namely all the forces in the beginning of the universe were a single force, and as the universe expanded out, they split off and developed different characteristics. And so we're still trying to understand how are the different forces connected, and we already know that at least two of the forces are connected, electricity and the weak nuclear force. There's a theory which now very accurately describes that. And so what we're doing in modern physics is trying to understand these interconnections. And the thing that I find fascinating about the research that I've been involved in is that it takes the very, very small, so the smallest fundamental particles, and it connects them to what's going on with the expansion of the universe and, you know, scales of megaparsecs. And it's that connection and unity which takes somebody with, you know, real creativity to connect those things together. So that's why I think, you know, I look at science as much as an art as as an actor or a sculptor or an artist would.
Well, that's interesting that you talk about taking all this data and using the powers of discernment in the same way that an artist has to use powers of discernment. Historically, do you feel that those powers of discernment are cultural? In other words, in terms of scientific knowledge, there is a limitation and then an opening up of the kind of discernment and therefore scientific knowledge you have when culture changes?
It certainly is culturally related. If you look at different societies throughout the history of the human race, there are some which have made very great progress. There's others which have been in existence for, you know, thousands of years, or hundreds to a thousand years or more, who didn't make much progress. So, for example, if you look at the ancient Greeks, they came up with many new concepts about the nature of matter, of truth, all sorts of philosophies, but also very physical exercises. What is the universe around us? What's it made up of? How do you test that? You look at the Romans, great empire, fantastic organization, basically not much additional philosophy. They took things from the Greek. They didn't invent any new theories of the world around them. They simply organized and operated. And the reason for that is that they had very different cultural approaches to life around them. You see that in the modern world also. If you look at the difference between the East and the West, the West tends to be very independent, very individually driven. The East tends to be more societal driven. How do you work together to do things? And in the East, traditionally, you're supposed to fit in. So you're supposed to work with others, accommodate, not express your own opinions, put yourself forward. You're supposed to work as a group. That has tended to really limit creativity.
Including scientific.
That's changing over time. But if you look back 20 or 30 years ago, the East, so Japan, China, were very good at taking a new invention and sort of commercializing it. So most of the inventions didn't occur so much in China or Japan as they did in the United States, but they were much better at taking an idea and making it work. They're moving now more and more in the direction of trying to drive creativity, trying to have some independence. And so things evolve over time. But if you look at back in history at the great leaders, you know, 100 years ago, Germany dominated the scientific scene. And it was because of their approach to education. That faded over time. They're still very strong, but others, particularly the United States, largely because of our education system, really excelled. Our universities were the best in the world. That drove creativity. It drove a lot of the scientific insight. It's not to say you don't have geniuses, you know, poking up here and there, but on a general level, there are differences in how you approach science and progress you make based on culture.
We're talking to Tom Bowles, science advisor to Governor Bill Richardson. And once again, he's speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex in a program called We're Missing Most of the Universe, which is part of the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. So what is you're in government now, but what is your own background as a research scientist?
So my background is, you know, I grew up during the Star Trek era. I always liked science. I was very interested in it as a kid. When I was 16, I decided I wanted to become a nuclear physicist because that was sort of something very exotic, far out. You could really probe new things. Sounded very challenging, very exciting. Ended up spending some time doing music. I was in a band for a while. Decided I was not going to make a living at that. Ended up going to graduate school at Princeton. Got into this area of sort of the new physics. What is particles? How do particles, how are they created? How do they relate to the rest of the universe? Astrophysics. just driven in part by some of the visual images that you see coming out of telescopes and so on. Then I spent about 20 years of my life, 20-odd years, working in very large collaborations to understand some fundamental questions. One is, there's a particle called a neutrino. A neutrino is a fundamental particle that is extremely weakly interacting. A neutrino will go through the entire Earth like it was a plate of glass. Very weakly interacting. Turns out, for various reasons, neutrinos look like they're one of the keys to solving how matter, how different forces are connected to one another.
What are they?
So it's like a photon, like a photon of light, but it is a separate particle. A photon actually is a carrier of force. A neutrino does not carry a force, but that concept of having a finite-sized particle traveling through space and time, it interacts only, we thought it interacted only through the weak nuclear force. We found out now neutrinos actually have mass, very, very small amount of mass in each one. It's the lightest particle in the universe. But those particles were formed during part of the Big Bang. There's still a huge relicsy of neutrinos, and it turns out that all the neutrinos in the universe have as much mass as all the stars do. And so some of the experiments I worked on came to that conclusion. And in order to observe these neutrinos, we built very large detectors, I mean the size of a 10-story, you know, office building, deep underground. So I spent a lot of time in Russia in an experiment there, where neutrinos produced in the core of the sun from the fusion reactions that produce energy in the sun, neutrinos travel out, they come to the Earth. Once in a while, one of them will interact in a large detector, and we can measure that interaction, deduce how many neutrinos are produced in the sun, and compare that to theory. We then went a step further, and in Canada, we worked in a large collaboration, which took... The Canadians loaned us $300 million worth of heavy water, so water in which hydrogen is replaced with deuterium. And we used that so that neutrinos coming in from the sun would generate a flash of light. We would observe that. But they could also break up the deuteron. Instead of just producing a flash of light, they could break it up into its constituents, a neutron and a proton.
Remind us what heavy water is a little more specifically.
Okay. So heavy water is...
Water is H2O. H2O is...
H2O has two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom. Heavy water has the hydrogen replaced with deuterium. Deuterium has not just a proton in the nucleus, but it's got a neutron.
So otherwise it's just like hydrogen.
It's just like hydrogen, but it weighs twice as much.
Because it's got a neutron. So protons and neutrons weigh the same.
Very close to each other. And so it's called heavy just because it's basically the same as water, but it weighs more.
Okay, so you're both breaking up this heavy water and using it to...
So there's different reactions that we could look at in the heavy water. And what we determined in that experiment was actually the neutrinos are produced in three different types. You can think of them sort of as three different colors, but there's three different types. And... because of the different reactions, we could sort out what's what, whether it was one type or a different type. And it turns out that neutrinos, as they're produced in the sun in one type, on their flight from the sun to the Earth, they change spontaneously into a different type. And that transformation tells us something very fundamental about the properties of matter and how forces are related to one another. And it's been very interesting from a couple of aspects. So to come back to sort of the cultural part of things, these are experiments which take you 10 years to build and to run them. There's typically dozens to hundreds of people involved in the experiment itself. They cost tens to hundreds of millions of dollars to do. And because of that, the world has to join together to carry out something of that scale. And different countries have different capabilities. So in Russia, they had the materials that we needed for the detector, and we had the electronics. In Canada, again, they had the heavy water. We had other capabilities. And so you end up working cross-culturally to probe some of the most fundamental questions about what's the origin of matter in the universe, what are forces, what are their interactions with each other. Again, trying to come back to understanding, is there a single theory that describes everything?
So if you have these neutrinos that are emitted from the nuclear reaction in the sun, they go flying across whatever, 93,000 miles to Earth, they transform along the way, what happens to them then? I mean, are they already here? Is the Santa Fe Baking Company full of neutrinos?
Yes. In fact, if you look at your thumb, there are 100 million neutrinos.
And where
going
are they?
Your
are they,
thumb
are they
every
in,
second.
Are they in the atoms of that?
No, they're just free flowing.
They're free. They're, okay.
Just the way that light goes and flows, moves all around. Neutrinos basically don't get reflected the light the way light does because they're so weakly interacting. But you know, in your thumb, in your fingernail, going through there, there's 100 million neutrinos a second going through it. And maybe once in your life, one of those neutrinos will actually interact, not just simply pass through. They'll cause some effect in your body.
So what kind of effect will they cause in your body, and what kind of effect do they cause elsewhere?
They can drive a reaction in which one element is changed to another element. They can get absorbed.
They can change one element to another element?
Yep. So if you go back
they're
to the idea of
alchemists,
alchemy.
Right.
Yeah. So in fact, in Russia, what we were looking for is we had 60 tons of liquid molten gallium metal. And about once a day, the neutrinos from the sun coming in would change one gallium atom into a germanium atom.
Are they close to each other on the periodic table?
They're right next to each other. And so our job was to detect that single germanium atom in the presence of these trillions of trillions of other atoms.
It's, in a way, fascinating. And in a way, I mean, with great respect, it seems like the ultimate knowledge for its own sake, but not necessarily useful. Or tell me how that's not correct, if it's not.
Yeah. It's a very good question. And the analogy that I'll use is with radio waves. So 150 years ago, people thought, oh, radio, what is this? This electromagnetic radiation, it's not good for anything. You can't see it, you can't touch it, you can't feel it. That's interesting, but so what?
And here we are today.
And here we are today. And so part of it is, how do we understand how the different forces work with each other? How do we understand what the basis for radiation, radioactivity is from a fundamental basis? You know, maybe that will lead to something that's important. But the other aspect of this is that we keep developing better and better technologies to detect these neutrinos. And one of the problems is, because they're so weakly interacting, you know, there's natural radioactivity all around us, just in the rock and dirt coming in from outer space. So we keep developing better and better ways to discriminate and shield and separate that background radiation from what we're looking for. So one of the effects that that had already is in the semiconductor industry. So as people make more and more powerful computers, they keep making all the parts smaller and smaller and smaller. And they got down to the point where there are such small dimensions, so a little piece of memory in a computer chip, an external radioactivity ray can come in, a beta ray or a gamma ray or an alpha particle can come in. It can actually disrupt that memory bit and spontaneously cause the memory to change its state from a 0 to a 1. And that happens because of external radiation. Turns out that the companies who were making these, the materials they needed to purify the materials they used in this to get rid of the natural radioactivity in the materials, they had no way to measure what that radioactivity level is because they had gotten it so pure that they couldn't measure anything. But it still was not pure enough for their application. It was still causing problems. So various scientists worked with them to provide new ways to make even purer materials. And what happened is that the electronics industry had a problem. They'd make these giant, you know, 6 or 8 inch wafers with a million, 10,000 different chips on them, millions of transistors, and they would have to throw a lot of them away because of this radioactivity problem. We improved their processes, so now their yields went up dramatically, which saved them a lot of money.
So some of the research, like the research you've been involved in, has applications way later on that couldn't have been predicted when you started the research.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of it is, for example, my own research group at Los Alamos was developing computer codes to run our experiments and to take data. During Project Desert Storm, our group actually took that, translated it over to an airborne detection system to look for anthrax attacks on our troops. And it was because we had already all those capabilities in place for detection, for monitoring, checking. We could just take it and translate it directly to, in that case, a Homeland Defense application.
We're talking to Tom Bowles, science advisor to Governor Bill Richardson. Here's just a little question. You've got a nucleus, it's made up of protons and neutrons. Protons are all positive, neutrons are all neutral.
Right.
How come the protons and neutrons stay together since it's only positive inside that space?
Right. So that's because of the strong nuclear force. The strong nuclear force exchanges particles called bosons, which...
Bosons?
Yeah.
I never heard of bosons.
Okay. There's this will get into a particle theory course, which I don't...
We may not want to do all of it on the radio.
But the four forces, they're actually mediated by particles called bosons. The photon is a boson. And those forces can be attractive, repulsive. In the case of the nucleus, the protons are pushing apart from each other because of their electrical charge. That's the electromagnetic force. But they're also at the same time held together by the strong nuclear force, which has a different type of particle, a different boson that it exchanges. And the neutrons help stabilize that because they add to the attractive part, but they don't provide the electrical repulsion at the same time.
You said a little while ago that Einstein, one of the things that Einstein said was that at the beginning there was one great big force and it differentiated into other kinds of forces.
Right.
Are we still in that process where in the future there may be even more kinds of forces than that?
Very good question, and one that we don't know the answer to. One of the real questions is, what's the source of dark energy? Is that a new force in nature? We just don't know the answer to that. One of the other questions that scientists ask is, why are there three dimensions to the universe? You know, up, down, left, right, forward, backward. Why aren't there four or five or eight?
I thought there were. I thought there were physicists who could tell you about 32 dimensions.
Well, there are groups who postulate that the universe started off actually with 10 dimensions, and seven of those... I'm sort of putting time aside as a separate dimension, but those compacted down into the three known dimensions that we have, and somewhere there's a little residual bit of stuff that is these other dimensions that is so small that you just don't normally ever see it. So there may be sort of another universe within our universe that we just can't see because those dimensions have been shrunk down to such a small size that they're just not visible to us. But with new tools, new experiments, better sensitivity, maybe we'll be able to see something at a very, very small level that says there's more to the universe even than we thought.
of the research that's going on right now in theoretical physics, what is the most exciting of that to you?
Probably something called string theory. String theory is a theory that tries to describe everything, how gravity, how all particles are related to one another. And the idea is that at a very fundamental level, you have a string which is just the way that a violin string would vibrate. So the universe is filled up of these little tiny strings, and depending on how it vibrates, it manifests itself as a quark or as an electron or something else. And it's one potential way of unifying everything down to a single concept, namely you have the string that's vibrating, and how it vibrates determines what it actually is.
Now, what is this string? I mean, it's not made of nylon or
no,
hemp.
No, it's typically described as, I don't know if defect is the right word, but as a structure in space and time of, you know, extremely small dimension. So it's basically what we call a topological defect. So the same way that a black hole sort of deforms space and time, a string could be a deformation.
Does it have mass?
By the fact that it vibrates, it generates mass. And how fast it vibrates determines what the mass of that particular particle would be.
But is it made up of particles? Like, you've been talking about particles
all day.
It
is the fundamental entity in the universe. Everything else is made up of that.
Everything else is made up of the string.
Right. This is a fairly esoteric idea.
Well, it is. And again, I mean, it fires up the poetic imagination. But it's hard to, you know, not that we're supposed to grasp it here on the radio with no training, but it's hard to grasp something which doesn't have mass and it vibrates, but you're not sure what it is that's vibrating.
Yeah, at this point, it's really a mathematical construct. Does it exist in actuality? We don't know. The problem with it is that right now, the mathematics is so complicated in it that it's hard to generate specific predictions that, for example, such a particle would weigh so much, something else would weigh so much and change. So it's at a very early stage, and what they're called string theorists, what they are trying to do is actually tie those calculations down to something that has specific predictions that is different from other theories, so that you can go out and test it. Whether or not we'll be able to actually do that remains to be seen, I think. So.
Well, we haven't even talked about clean energy and telecommunications and economic development and all the other people who are working with you at the governor's office. We've only got a couple of minutes left. Can you give us just a quick overview about what the science folks are doing in the governor's office in the state of New Mexico?
Right. So the governor's office has the responsibility of trying to integrate and coordinate activities across the state. We've got an incredible number of really smart people all across the state, everywhere you go. And I don't just mean scientists. I mean, some of the smartest people I know are farmers and ranchers. And they come up with new ideas for how to clean water, how to improve efficiencies of buildings and things, how to generate new electrical sources. And so we work to get people together, and the federal government funds a lot of very basic research here in New Mexico. We get about $6 billion a year from the federal government for basic research. And some of that's in energy and water and environment and so on. And what we're trying to do in the governor's office is to take that basic research, those ideas, and turn them into real efforts where they create jobs, create a new type of solar array, for example, where you would manufacture them here in New Mexico. So we connect the different pieces. We provide some state funding to get them across what's called the Valley of Death, the Valley of Death is, you have a really good idea, but nobody wants to take it to a stage where you make it real and something you can build. And so you got to cross this valley, and most people don't make it across it. They've got a great idea, but no way to turn it into reality. So the state helps people move across the Valley of Death. And the goal is to raise the standard of living of New Mexicans here. So instead of having all minimum wage jobs, let's get clean factories, clean energy here with much higher paying jobs.
And I hope we'll have the opportunity to talk in more depth about these things on this program. I'd like to thank you so much for being here, Tom Bowles, science advisor to Governor Bill Richardson, on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
And Tom Bowles will be speaking tonight at the Santa Fe Science Cafe for Young Thinkers. The talk is titled, We're Missing Most of the Universe. It's from 6 to 7:30 tonight at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum Education Annex at 123 Grant Avenue in Santa Fe. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the colors of jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.